I know that the scriptures say that we shouldn't take the upper seats at the feast, but we invite those of you who have given heed to that scriptural admonition to come up forward. Since we have no microphone, and we have to rely, as King Benjamin did, on just the spoken word coming, booming out of our voices. Trying to remember which modern American poet, Mary Catullus, who said, "Poetry makes nothing happen."
Archibald MacLeish.
Pardon? Archibald MacLeish. I thought it was a woman, but I guess it wasn't. Poetry makes nothing happen, but the world couldn't live without it. The world depends on poetry and on poets. Oh, and on flowers, which we don't want to be in the obscuring Mary. Mary Bradford has been one of the persistent and eloquent and passionate voices, not only in poetry, but for poetry and with poetry in the Mormon community for as long as I can remember. I have read her poems with delight for many years. I've been privileged to be a correspondent as she and I have sent our poems back and forth, knowing that they were going to be read by somebody who loved us, and but also somebody who was hopefully willing to be honest and open with us about how things might be made a little bit better. And as I said to Mary, thank heaven she didn't follow all of my suggestions. This book of poetry, Power to the Purple, which is available for signings and for especially reading, is going to be available in the book place after this session. So if you haven't got a copy, I would encourage you to buy 10. Poets also need to live, although perhaps not hopefully entirely by the word. Mary's idea about this session was a lovely idea, which was that it wasn't just a celebration of her poems, but a celebration of other poets that she loves and has shared the poetic voice with. And so today, those of us on the program are going to be reading some of Mary's poems and some of our own poems. And so we will try to, it probably would be made clear which were hers and which are ours anyway, but we'll try to make that that distinction. Dixie Barlow has been a poet well known in the Mormon community, and Maribel Clough, Paul Swenson, I think these are all poetic voices that that you are familiar with, and if you aren't, that you should be. I would, Mary, did you want to say some words before we begin? So I'm going to turn the time over to Mary, and then we will each take turns reading some of Mary's poems and some of ours.
Thank you, Bob. Now, Bob has a good loud voice. I hope we can follow suit. Did everyone get a reading copy of the poems? Thanks. I decided to form a new party called the Purple Party. Combines blue and red. And it's a very good poetry party. So I think that Bob has given me a great introduction to this. And I've never done anything without help from my friends, so I decided to get them all here. On the end there is my gifted typesetter and poet. He's the one who designed the cover and helped me with the making it readable throughout. So I'm glad to have him on the program, too. Some of those, I knew that this was going to be opposite the most popular session why I stay. So I called up a bunch of people and said, get your bodies here. And so I'm glad to see you. Eloise Bell has come all the way from Oklahoma. She's been a very strong inspiration for me. I went to her Crohn workshop in the early 90s, was it? In which we talked about what to do in an old age. The word Crohn in America is not a good word, but in Ireland it's a great word. It means sage, storyteller, healer, and it's a good word. So I got a whole new conception of what it meant to be older from her workshop and from Ireland. So that's why Brant picked up on it, and he sent out the press release saying, come in, Mark. It said, get in touch with your inner crone. So I told him that I was going to call my collection the Crone Poems at first. And he said, well, that's a winner. Why didn't you? And I said, because in this country, they don't have any good word for women. So I decided not to. Sue Booth Forbes wrote the introduction to the book. She runs the Artist Retreat, Writers and Artists Retreat in Southwest Cork, where I put together the collection. Very inspiring place if you get a chance to go. And Susan Howe was over there with me, and she helped me put together my first collection too. So I'm glad to see everyone. Marilyn Miller, the artist, was supposed to be here. She lives in Idaho, but she got sick. She painted this mountain especially for the book. So I was so happy to have her artwork because she worked on dialogue with me back in the 70s and did the only embossed cover dialogues ever had. So I was happy to have her work. I thought I'd read, first I would read the signature poem, Purple Poem. You may recall it about 20 years ago, this poem came out called When I Grow Old, I Shall Wear Purple. Remember that one? And I said, gee, I've been wearing purple my whole life. What's the deal? And the idea was, when you get older, you can do anything. People don't care. You can wear any odd color.
Well, if they do care, you don't.
Right. And after a while, nobody cares. So I wrote this, trying to define purple. I was wearing purple when I was only 40. A full-length purple coat with a zipper men call sexy as a snaked up and down. During the miniskirt craze, when younger women wore their skirts up to the elbows, I found a modest purple dress and matching stockings. Now that I'm old, I wear amethyst, I have it here, and a heather jacket. Mother's lilacs bloom over the fireplace, and grandmother's orchid quilt covers my widow's bed. Purple is the chakra of the third eye, the color of bruises, the color of mourning, the color of healing. And of course, other people have some ideas what that means. And also on the book's cover is a flower, the only poem about a flower. One day I was reading Thomas Hardy. He had a poem about a chrysanthemum, and I remembered the mother grew those in the winter. And I thought, used to think, how can she do that? Little red ones. Chrysanthemum, a winter flower, peaks before the snow. Traveling by the Silk Road, sharp-tongued and gold, it is cultivated in China, celebrated in Japan as show, then flaming and bold, brightens my mother's bower. So I'll turn the time over to a next reader, which I think is Paul Swinson. Thank you.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. Glad you're here. This is Mary's poem called Homage. It mentions another poet who I have an interest in, Mae Swenson. I'll try to do it justice. Mae Swenson's body was her house. It was also her hound and horse. What noble architect designed this house? What farrier her horse? What priestly veterinarian administered the last rites to her bright dog? Who will repair my own low shack with its thatched roof, its mud floor, with its snuffling cur waiting at the door to nip my heels as I run from death? What broken-backed nag will carry me to the scribe who waits to catch the yearning words in my last breath? Beautiful stuff. This poem is a very old poem of mine. I'm reading it as sort of an homage to Mary because of the title. Night of the Purple Sky. Four spears of asparagus in a white dish, nubbed, thorny. Four Carlton 120s in a tray of ash, all pointing east. This family, what's left of it, is imagining itself in Jamaica. Mango the bird wings the kitchen, orange and green, preening for a flight to the Indies. Placemats, rectangular, rubied orchards of peaches, grapes, and pomegranates. Fresh from the basement dig, a letter from her dead father and a pair of ballet slippers. From the closet, a high school yearbook photo of her elfin self, exhumed by her dark daughter. Outside, above the tunnel of trees in the street, trimmed just today, the sky is midnight blue to orchid. Cutter's corn, I'll bring you some this summer, she says, forgetting she is leaving. It's like ambrosia. And hope leaps up like promise, the color of the sun.
When Mary sent me her book of poems and said, pick one that you'd like to read of mine and one of yours, I had, as she knows, a great deal of difficulty. She kept saying, choose something, and I had a very hard time doing it. The connection between these two poems is perhaps a little tenuous, but perhaps you will see the connection. This is Mary's poem of the Word. The Word was made flesh, and the flesh made words. He fed the 5,000 on words shaped like loaves, as fragrant as the breath of God, easy to digest, sweet as honey. His words were liquid as the water where fishes spawn, bracing as rain, cool to the taste. Blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are the peacemakers, blessed are the meek. The 5,000 were filled and refreshed. For one whole season, they were pure and peaceful and meek. Breath. At Treasures from Sinai, an 11th century icon, angels and shepherds surrounding the Christ child, and animals in dumb adoration. Seeing a small boy stare intently, I say, see, the donkey is looking at Jesus. He examines the painting more closely, then turns to his father, an Orthodox priest in a long black cassock, who says, when Jesus was born, all creation gave him gifts. Heaven gave him stars, the earth gave him straw, and the animals gave him breath. Lying in the manger, Jesus feels the moist breath, warm as the light on his face, breathes in the fragrance of wheat and barley, rendless he will remember when he multiplies the loaves and when the devil tempts stones into bread. On the many nights when he has no place, he lies down with the animals, escaping into sleep on new-cut hay. Later, riding into Jerusalem over carpets of straw and flowers, of palms and tree branches, the hosannas ringing, he recalls some deepest memory enfolded in his mother's love, those first aromas and the nascent friendship of beasts. As the throngs sing out his name, he looks toward the great city with its white walls and golden domes. On the slow path down the Mount of Olives, he notices for the first time the black furred cross on the donkey's back, lifts his eyes to the dark hills beyond, and, taking a deep breath, descends.
We look to, in the selection of these poems, we look to relate one of ours to one of Mary's, and these two are about works of art. Mary's very aptly a powerful image of woman called African tribal woman. I am in the standing position, clothed in 1,000 vows, the nails and wedges of law driven into my shoulders, exposed in my navel. My eyes are aligned and alive and slit in the erotic mode. I hold my breasts with both hands in perfect balance, my flexed knees supporting the blessings of 1,000 matrilinear years. When you look on me, Galeri man, wear the carved mask and kneel. The Old Guitarist by Pablo Picasso in the Art Institute of Chicago. The Old Guitarist moves from gallery wall with a long-seated blue stare and floats, forming dark blue clouds over the desert. Don't let him play. He strums his own storms. The guitar is strung with man's own gut, and his fingers pluck the muted music of our pain. No wonder he reigns on the world. He absorbs all that is bent and bowed and blued in us.
Oh, Mary and I have been friends for so long. I think it might have been another life when it started. We used to haul our kids off to the zoo. We took them to every free thing in Washington. And that day is coming back to me very vividly. We were hauling Scott and Matthew and my little kids, and I think Lorraine and Mandy were just fresh from making peanut butter and soda sandwiches. I don't know the concoctions they dreamed to make of. Awful, but she wrote this poem for me. And what year do you think you wrote this? What year was it when you were 6?
It would take us forever to cross the bridge.
All day.
We got there, we had to have lunch. By the time we had lunch, we had time to see one animal.
And Mary would say, "I can't stand it anymore, let's go home." Zoo gloom. A child set loose sees his toy giraffe grow through branches, stripped and bowed in winter wind. Trees change to bars that cage the cats. Can these swift creatures pace the summer back? The black monkey's swollen cry catches my breath. Can he hear me scratching, laughing, keening the desolate air? You can see we found the zoo a very cheerful place. Ah, Africa. Why did I go to Africa? To hear the dark poetry of her people, to learn her names. Karumbu, Mercy Karamana, Adet Kashi, Yuma Magogo, Ali Mazuru, Gakanju, Kakangwa. I'm a specialist at doing nothing. Still, being still, I hear drums and want to dance. Be still and follow the energy up. Kawani Trusu, do you? What do you do? I think of never working again. Is work sacred? What is my work? Is work a privilege? Ask Mombasa. Ask those in Kibera slums. There are no drums. My work was over, and then I saw the faces of Kenya, Maru, Samburu, Naivasha, Nakuru, Masamara, Tanzania, Zanzibar. I will never be the same. What is the change? More joy, more presence, more abundance. Better able to perceive light coming, 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 growing. If they trust, why wouldn't I? I see how I procrastinate, afraid I'll finish, and then what? Go back again to Africa with you? I have no words in my language to tell you without pictures of their faces and their joy, even laughing and crying with me, dancing and growling and whispering, come, come, and again.
So when Dialogue asked me to help them publish this book for Mary, I just done an index. I was pretty swamped and didn't really want any extra projects, but I opened the text file and I saw Honoring Emily on the table of contents, and so it was pretty much a done deal. I knew that I had to be in on this any way I could. I know Bob might have wanted this poem, but I got it first. You'll see the different ways that we both had of honoring Emily in our poems. I'll read one that I based on her after. She dealt in miniatures, engraving them on flotsam. They filled her room, her hall, then the world. She herself was miniature, only 5 feet tall, and dressed in white. Yet her passion flummoxed all the men she ever met. You didn't have to die. I could have been persuaded to relinquish you. You had only to say the word, back off, stand back. Don't stand so close. My little gifts I could take back. The scarf, the amber clip, the poems, yes, all the poems, mine and yours, with all the Irish songs. Is God so jealous that he would deliberately keep me from thee? Or does he find me so attractive that he is preparing a place in his heavenly harem? No, I prefer space on this lonely earth filled by your requiem and brighter far than his arrogant star. So, Mary had her way of honoring Emily in a way which was very direct, which shows a poet who's much more confident in her resources and her sources and her generosity. And that's something that I've really learned about revisiting some poems that I'd written. And this poem I wrote because I saw a bird on the grass, and the familiar lines from Dickinson's poem, I saw a bird come down the walk he did not know I saw, and he picks up the worm, he bites the fellow raw. Well, the poem had informed my ideas of the world, so seeing the bird on the lawn, I assumed it was a live bird, it would get up and move soon. It didn't, and you'll see what happens. I kind of write the sequel, I guess, here, and that's my way of honoring Emily.
I saw it down on the lawn, and uncertain it saw me, bent forward myself and saw the bird, indeed one at least unbreathing, one nevermore to become deceased. Therewith, with wings uptight, like it was dressed for a service, where it might be served as the bird, when in afternoon latterly flies would flit digestatorily like they were desultory guests. Perhaps presuming, or perhaps they knew, that worms, too, would be joining the party as they rose tomorrow through moisture of morning's dew.
Now we have time to start over again. So I'm going to have Bob read the second time around. Paul runs a writer's group, which is open, so you could go. And it's at Bell's house. It's a great group. I've been to it myself and helped it to gain the courage to write.
Writers group, by the way, is going to be a week from tomorrow night at Belclough's house. Yes, if any of you are inclined in the audience. Can we say that, Bill?
Yes, please.
2222 South, 2100 East, 7 p.m. A week from tomorrow night. Come if you will. So, here we go. This is Mary's poem, Upstream. Poetry is about surviving. The poet must leap into the river, swimming upstream, gulping air, calling to the barge. Readers know nothing of this. They climb aboard, sighing in relief. Poetry is about conniving. The poet grasps a sliver of the barge, a mote, a beam, anything to engage, to enlarge the range of bliss as it finally merges with belief. The poem I'm going to read of mine is a very new poem. I haven't shared it with many people. I did read it in writing group, I think. I'm not quite sure what it means, and if you have any ideas, come up and tell me afterwards. It's called Nature of the Beast. The natural man, God's fool, Paul said. By nature, man, referring Genesis, finessed, misled by woman, devolved in stature, lower than the angels. Once fallen, perfect body, conscious of desire, mind perceived it flawed and sinful, covered it in skins of animals, but modesty did not put out the fire. The natural woman, shame was not innate in her, refused to hearken to dictates of her mate or blame the serpent. For her, felt natural in the lovely, dark, and sensuous pelts of beasts. Evicted from the garden, found she could regard the stark and wild as beautiful. Embrace the earth, the sky, and childbirth. The animal, shy but fierce, drinks from instinct, no need to think or reason. Natural man envies creature's freedom, yet denies the link. Hears exultant cry of grandeur, new thrill of innocence and fear pierce the wilderness. Afraid to die, irony like blood seeps through. Man works his will to hunt and kill. The word, so long deferred by natural man, now blurred, Woman heard the whisper, ate the fruit, discerned light from dark, bent the arc of patriarchy. Wisdom or duty, natural or unnatural, anomalies of nature, lion and lamb, man and man, lie down, choose to lie down together. Muse, the nature of the beast. Thank you.